I'm Rachel Greenberg, and this is the 2018 episode of Volta Insider. Welcome back. The role of White House Social Secretary demands expertise in courtesy and diplomacy. You must manage the egos and whims of the President of the United States, the First Lady, and all of the guests visiting the White House, all while executing the highest of high-profile events. I'm excited to talk to two people who have managed it all and now have written a book to help the rest of us, called Treating People Well: The Extraordinary Power of Civility at Work and in Life. Welcome Jeremy Bernard, who worked for President Obama, and Lee Berman, President Bush's White House Social Secretary. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
So first, tell us about the job. What does it entail? What are your favorite parts of it?
What's interesting about the job is it's so interesting because there is no typical day. Often started early, could have been an arrival ceremony or something, an event that was going to happen first thing in the morning, and then there could be a dinner at night. And then the next day, there might not be anything. So it was constantly changing and a lot of last-minute decisions. But we were basically responsible for anything that took place in the mansion or Rose Garden, everywhere in the White House except for the Oval Office and the press room.
It's a lot of ground to cover.
It is, and a lot of events. There were probably at least 350 events a year.
Oh, wow.
Lots of times when there were multiple events in a day, and then the holiday season was especially intense.
Oh, my goodness.
And at times of the year when most people are having downtime, like August, we're working ferociously to get Christmas organized.
Oh.
Yeah, it's really was somewhat of a challenge to get Mrs. Obama, because she'd make the decisions of what the decor and which way we were going. And it was always one of those really hot, humid days. And we would have this meeting, and it's like, I can't believe we're talking about Christmas at the end of July.
So but who wants to talk about velvet when it's this hot outside?
Exactly. You know what it's like.
Because it's so constantly evolving, how much of it do you learn on the job? How much of your past experience helped prepare you for this job?
We were both from a fundraising background, so I think we both had a lot of event experience, and that was really helpful. It's also helpful for the social secretary to know who the political players are, who the friends of the president are. And so if you've worked in a campaign, you're more likely to know that. It gives you a leg up once we all started at the White House.
Okay.
But the truth is, it's also you learn on the job. I mean, we did a lot of learning on the job. And this book, one of the things that we kind of discussed is this is the book we wish we had before we started the job. But you look back and you see things where maybe you didn't handle something as well. And all, this makes you focus more on the moment and on being polite. And being someone that lives in L.A. now with traffic, I think about it every time I'm about to hit the horn, and it takes patience and a lot of work.
And that's really the point of the book, is the things we learned are applicable to everybody's life. You know, everyone has difficult moments and awkward times, and we explain very practically and specifically how to walk into a room full of people you don't know at all and introduce yourself around and make yourself comfortable, or what to do about that cranky neighbor who keeps running over your trash cans, or, you know, how to get along a little better with your boss and build a better sense of communication and trust with him. There are all these universal elements of treating people well. I've been around since the ancient Greeks, but I think sometimes people tend to forget how useful they can be.
And what inspired you to come together and actually write the book?
We became friends shortly after I arrived in D.C. for the job. And there's a tradition that the outgoing or most recent social secretary hosts a lunch for the new social secretary. And that's where we met. And then Lee had a luncheon for me that I was nervous about. I thought it was going to be very, very formal and very, kind of
rigid
and uptight. And I had so much fun. It was a mix of Democrats. But I had so much fun. And then we would see each other, and I would have an issue about an entertainer canceling or some last minute. I'd call Lee and say, "How did you ever deal with this?" And I mean, I hate to say misery loves company, but when she'd say, Oh, yeah. That happened. I felt better about it.
Speaking of the White House, how do you guys manage crowd control? You talk about the chicken walk in the book. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, we were very fortunate to have a group of officers who, as volunteers, would come and work as social aides in the White House at all of the events. And they would be organized to help people find their way inside. They'd show them how to move within the White House, where they could go, very gently tell them where they couldn't go. They would organize the receiving lines, and we created a system so that people didn't have to wait too long in line. And without them, I don't know how we would have moved crowds as easily, because people tend to listen to a person in uniform.
Yes, it was very helpful with the photos of the president and first lady, to have, because they have a push and pull, someone that introduces, and as soon as they're introduced, they're placed in the spot for the picture, and then the other officer comes over and shows them the way out, and it happens so quickly, smoothly, and like Lee said, people tend to listen to what someone in uniform says, especially at the White House.
Could you take us inside of a state dinner? It's sort of a magical thing that people don't really know about it, but you guys, you organize them, you see them up close.
Well, they take months of planning, and the state dinner is the culmination of the day. It usually begins with the state arrival ceremony, and 5,000 to 7,000 people on the South Lawn welcoming the visiting head of state. And then there are meetings with the president. There's often some kind of coffee with the first ladies, if there is a first lady coming. And then there's a luncheon, usually a working luncheon, a series of other meetings. Often the first ladies go off together and do something, visit a museum, plant a tree, something like that. So it involves thousands of people and a lot of coordination. And then the dinner is kind of the icing on the cake. And most of what happens at state dinners and at state arrival ceremonies and all of those things are pre-cooked. The arrangements in a policy sense have been made, and it's just a nice way of being gracious and showing friendship to another country.
Yeah, it's a constant, the day is just a constant change of one event to the other, because after the working lunch, they usually do a press conference. And so you're constantly changing rooms around, because it will be a press conference, and then a few hours later, it could be dinner, it could be the entertainment. So it was one of those, it was a special day, it was always exciting, and always thrilled when it was over.
Both of you worked closely with the first ladies. What was that like? Was it difficult to form a relationship with them? Did they want to be involved? Was it kind of like pulling teeth? Give us sort of insight onto what it was like to work with the first ladies.
Well, I think first ladies are as individual as each of them. And so Mrs. Bush was very interested in the details of hospitality, very hands-on. I actually learned a lot from her about paying more attention to details, because she would think through an event and she would imagine everything that was happening and the experience that the guests were having, so that they really enjoyed themselves and it was something memorable. For example, we had what was kind of a fairly ordinary President's Day celebration once, and we invited several Lincoln scholars to come and speak, and we invited a number of Lincoln historians to be guests. And just as the event was starting, she called me over and said, I would like all these people to be able to go visit the Lincoln bedroom. And so we arranged to do that, because that is not on the state floor, it's on the family floor. And so people usually don't see the Lincoln bedroom. And the Secret Service kind of grumbled, but they worked it out, of course. And it was so meaningful to these people who had been studying Lincoln all their lives and had never seen this room, the bedroom and the sitting room. And I realized what an enormous impact she made on those people and how they would never forget that. It was a really good lesson for me.
Wow.
So the first days at the White House were, every time the president, first lady walked into a room for an event, it was magical. It comes with a certain aura. But after a while, you get to know them more and more as people, and it develop a friendship. And so, but it's still your boss. But it was always, for me, working with both of them was actually a lot of fun, and I felt comfortable. And Mrs. Obama was involved in details on on the events that were most important to her, she was really involved, like the kids' state dinner. She wanted all the preparation and focus the same as it is for a regular state dinner. The kids' state dinner came from the one of the First Lady's initiatives about eating healthy. So kids submitted recipes for something that was healthy. And from each state, two people were picked, and they were invited to the dinner, and they obviously brought with them their either mother or father. And so it really wasn't a dinner. It was a lunch. But, you know, you had to be early. And instead of flowers, there were a lot of balloons. We always had someone making balloons, making animals out of it. So it was really always an amazing day. And the president always wanted to be aware of it, because no matter how busy, he loved stopping in and saying hello. So it was really magical.
That's so cute. Oh my God. What was your favorite memory of your time in the White House? Either a small thing, or, you know, after a day with 50 million events, you just finally sit down and say, oh, I'm so glad that's over. What was your favorite memory from
those
being
are two
the
different
White
things. There's favorite memory, and then there's the day you're so glad something is over. And for me, the congressional picnic was the day I was really glad when it was over, because it's a long day and it's a lot of moving parts. But my favorite memory was a time that we had a Hanukkah party, and someone had told me that a lot of people who came to the party weren't able to eat because the food wasn't kosher. So we arranged for a kosher caterer and a rabbi to come and kosherize the White House kitchen, and all the food was then kosher. And we put out discreet little signs on the buffet table that said, you know, that the food was kosher. And people were thrilled, and they really enjoyed it. And they got so excited at this particular party that when the Marine band, who was based in the Grand Foyer, started to play Hava Nagila, people started to dance the hora. And then there was this huge cry of happiness, and they kept playing it over and over, and more people joined and joined. And it was like this moment of spontaneous joy in the White House. It was just wonderful to see.
That's so lovely. Jeremy?
Gail Burt, who was one of the Reagan social secretaries, once told me that your first state dinner is like your first love. It will always be the most special and the most memorable. And she turned out to be right. They were all memorable, but there's so much pressure on the day of, and you want to make sure there's no mistakes, because it is so closely followed. And at the end of that state dinner that was out in the Rose Garden, it was beautiful. The president and first lady stopped, talked to me for about 10 minutes about how amazing the evening was. The next day, Mrs. Obama said to me, you know, during the dinner, Barack looked at me and said, you know, this is really great. This is beautiful. But you guys took a real risk, because it could rain. It's D.C. and it's June. And Mrs. Obama said, oh, Barack, we had a backup plan. And she looks at me, she goes, we did have a backup plan, didn't we? And I said, don't want to ask questions you don't want to know the answer to, which she laughed at.
There's a chapter in your book called Radiate Calm. Elaborate on what that means and why it's so important.
Well, people get very excited to come to the White House, as you might imagine, and it's a volatile atmosphere. Often at the beginning of the party, it feels a lot like the beginning of a kid's birthday party. You know, there's a lot of exuberance and barely controlled energy. And so we were all about soothing and smoothing and keeping everything happy and moving along properly. And so we found that radiating calm, no matter what was actually going on, by keeping our faces calm, by not playing into the drama when people got very emotional, by just refusing to engage, helped us to deal with these little things that would happen. Jeremy actually has a great story about
National Endowment for the Humanities Medal. One of the recipients was very upset with the president because the president was dealing with the budget or something, and he was with members of Congress. And President Obama, like President Bush, was very much off, you know, on time. He was sometimes ahead of schedule, but he was not one that usually ran late. This day he did, because he was in this meeting, they were negotiating, and he kept threatening to leave. And we finally convinced him that we'd have him get the medal first, and then he could leave. And he did, which is unusual because usually they all stay, obviously, in respect. But he could very well have had a family member sick or something, so I never asked. And that he had been back afterwards and was always incredibly pleasant. So I thought it was just a one day off. But it is an example of keeping calm when someone else is going off. This was one of the things that when I called Lee, I was like, did this happen to you? And she'd tell me, oh yes, and the drama and all that. So it's like any other job. And it just happens to be at the White House.
Going off of that, what is the meaning of the term charm offensive?
Well, I think when people referred to the book as being a charm offensive, they meant that we make the extra effort to make people feel very welcome. If it takes a little bit of humor or the ability to recognize something about them that you admire and point it out, even if it's something as small as, you know, I really like that tie, it makes them feel welcome. It makes them relax a little bit. And that's all to the good, because we all wanted everybody to have a great experience there. And it's an important point in the life of any person to be invited to the White House. It's something that most people remember the rest of their lives. It becomes a part of their family lore. And they often become, you know, sort of emotional when they look around and realize that as Americans, they share a common heritage with all the people who lived in that house. That's kind of an exciting moment to feel. And so we did everything we could to give people those moments.
I mean, Rachel, you've been there, and you know, yes. it, you first walk in, and it seems like a museum, and it's very formal. It's also, usually most people say, it's smaller than I thought it was. But you, even those that are not history buffs, really get a thrill out of seeing, walking through the halls, seeing the portraits, and kind of being a part of history.
How do you pick which celebrities to appear at the White House?
We start with, as soon as we get we have the information that there's going to be a state dinner, we start to find out as much as we can, sometimes with the State Department, sometimes we'll call someone directly in that country, to find out what that leader and their spouse, if there was any celebrity or singer or whatever that was their favorite. And then we would, and you'd also check on food and everything else, but it was often difficult to get them to answer it because they were like, oh, whatever you do is fine. And Mrs. Obama really wanted to know what it was they liked, and it sometimes took some prying past the State Department to get it. But that, and then you go through the whole vetting process to make sure that they're not behind on taxes, and that eliminated some. And then their availability. So it was always you had two or three on the list because you figured one would not be able to do it.
Some of the best White House moments are when a celebrity is there with the president. What was your favorite celebrity moment?
There was one time when the Australian Prime Minister came for a state dinner, and we had Kenny Chesney come to perform. And the gift that the president, Mrs. Bush, gave Kenny Chesney was a pair of handmade cowboy boots by Rocky Carroll. And he was so thrilled with them, sort of out of proportion to what they were. I mean, as nice as they were, that he took them and he got up on stage and immediately took off his shoes and put the boots on and looked down very admiringly and said, "The president sure knows what to give someone."
Oh my God.
And it was very sweet and sort of spontaneous.
That's so cute.
With President Obama, one of the, I think the first Kennedy Center honors that I was working at the White House for, Meryl Streep was one of the honorees. And I had not, I didn't realize she had not spent a lot of time with the Obamas. Over the years, she would. But at that point, it was still relatively new. And their families are together beforehand, and then you ask the families to go out and to sit in the state dining room for the president and all the honorees to come out. And I told Meryl Streep, "I'm sorry, we had to move all your family out." And this was in the it must have been in the green room. And she said, "Oh, don't worry. No, I'm glad they're gone. But come sit down with me. I'm nervous. And I was like, you're nervous? She goes, yes. I was like, oh, no, you shouldn't be nervous. I think the president's nervous. You know, I think he's nervous to meet you. So it was a moment where you realized that no matter who you are, it can really have a big, profound effect on you.
Mike Allen, co-founder and executive editor of Axios, wrote, every chapter is built around practical pointers, from ways to ease into a conversation and, better yet, get out, to the one time never to send a work email. Treating people well is a great service to people who think they've made it but actually have a ways to go, and is a huge gift to young people on their way up. You also have Senator John McCain and model Carly Kloss endorsing your book.
Did you want us to each read one of those?
Yeah.
You know what? I mean, I am horrible at reading. Can I have you read it?
Sure, I'd really be happy to.
After reading the audio book for 2 days, I realized that is not my strong suit.
That was not so easy.
No.
This was by John McCain. Treating people well is an essential guide for getting along and getting ahead in our world today. Authors Lee Berman and Jeremy Bernard show us how people from opposite ends of the political spectrum and all walks of life can build relationships, earn trust, and succeed by treating others with civility and respect. Full of life lessons that are both timely and timeless, this is a book that will be devoured, bookmarked, and read over and over again. Which was very nice of him.
It's very nice.
And then, let's see, Carly Kloss wrote, Lee and Jeremy's stories from the White House are not only fascinating, but reveal lessons about the ways we treat one another that can be applied universally. No matter your beliefs, background, or what you do for a living, there are takeaways from this book that will make each of us better human beings. By focusing on the things that unite us, love, kindness, and empathy, treating people well has the power to change the world for the better.
So you have a chapter in the book that deals with sort of the rules of thumb for managing an online presence. How would you advise millennials to manage their online presence?
Well, it keeps changing, so that makes it difficult. When I first got to the White House, everyone had phones, but the iPhone was just picking up steam. It was getting more and more popular. By the time I left, everyone came in with their phones, and which had the cameras, and it got to the point that for some of the events, we would have a check-in, like a coat check, where people would turn in their phones because Mrs. Obama wanted them to enjoy the moment there, live in that moment, and also not be capturing various people at a party, that they should not feel like they were being, put on camera. So it changed a lot. With my staff, I would always remind them, because sometimes I'd see them in a meeting reading their texts or emails, and I just reminded them how, I know that's it becomes more and more common, but how rude that seems to whoever is speaking or whatever the meeting's about. So I think the most important thing that I would take away is that you need to have time that you step away from it. And probably one of the best times is before bed, so you're not up answering emails constantly. But it really is important to have that, as with anything, you have to have time away from it. And that's getting tougher and tougher because there's so much out there.
Well, and the internet is forever. And if you don't separate your personal profile from the profile you want your future employer or a college recruiter to see, it can really come back and bite you. I mean, there were people who would apply for jobs and then we would look at their Facebook page and say, oh, I don't think so, you know, and I think that happens all the time now.
Yeah, I was amazed how many even interns got, it turned out that the vetting department said, yeah, we can't have it because of things they had posted on Facebook. So it is, Lee's point is right, it is forever. And it can affect you in the future. It's like a criminal record, but I don't want to say that because there's a lot of good.
Thank you both for being with me. You're the masters of etiquette, and I feel like I've become more polite in the last 30 minutes.
Well, thank you.
This has been such a pleasure.
Fun. Thank you so much.
Volta Insider is produced by Haddad Media and Feature Story News. Special thanks to Zach Huskins and Simon Marks for their generous help. I'm Rachel Greenberg for Volta Insider. Thank you for listening.